On November 22nd, our calculus teacher, Mr. Coe, was called out of class to the office. When he returned, he was white as a sheet and could hardly speak. He told us President Kennedy had been shot and probably killed in Dallas. I was devastated. Just 4 months before, I had seen him in the Rose Garden, so full of life and strength. So much of what he did and said, the inaugural address, the Alliance for Progress in Latin America, the cool handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Peace Corps, the stunning line from the Ich bin ein Berliner speech, freedom has many difficulties and democracy is not perfect, but we have never had to put a wall up to keep our people in. All these embodied my hopes for my country and my belief in politics. After class, all the students in the annex where our class met walked back to the main building. We were all so sad, all of us but one. I overheard an attractive girl who was in the band with me say maybe it was a good thing for the country that he was gone. I knew her family was more conservative than I was, but I was stunned and very angry that someone I considered a friend would say such a thing. It was my first exposure beyond raw racism to the kind of hatred I would see a lot of in my political career, and that was forged into a powerful political movement in the last quarter of the 20th century. I'm thankful that my friend outgrew it. When I was campaigning in Las Vegas in 1992, she came to one of my events. She'd become a social worker and a Democrat. I treasured our reunion and the chance it gave me to heal an old wound. As my senior year drew to a close, I became increasingly anxious about college. For some reason, I never even considered applying to any Ivy League school. I knew just where I wanted to go, and I applied only there, the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. I didn't want to go into the Foreign Service, and I had never even seen the Georgetown campus when I was at Boys Nation. But I wanted to go back to Washington. Georgetown had the best academic reputation in the city. The intellectual rigor of the Jesuits was legendary and fascinating to me, and I felt that I needed to know all I could about international affairs, and that somehow I would absorb all I could learn about domestic issues just by being in Washington in the mid-60s. In the second week of April, my acceptance notice from Georgetown arrived. I was happy, but by then I'd begun to question the wisdom of going. I didn't get a scholarship, and it was so expensive. $1,200 for tuition and $700 for room and fees, plus books, food, and other expenses. Although we were a comfortable middle-class family by Arkansas standards, I was worried that my folks couldn't afford it. And I was worried about being so far away and leaving Mother and Roger alone with Daddy, though age was slowing him down. My guidance counselor, Edith Irons, was adamant that I should go and that it was an investment in my future that my parents should make. Mother and Daddy agreed. Also, Mother was convinced that once I got there and proved myself, I'd get some financial help. So I decided to give it a shot. In my first 2 years at Georgetown, I rarely ventured beyond the confines of the university and its immediate surroundings, a small area bordered by M Street and the Potomac River to the south, Q Street to the north, Wisconsin Avenue to the east, and the university to the west. Though occasionally I felt cooped up in Georgetown, most days I was happy as a clam, absorbed in my classes and friends. However, I was also grateful for my few trips out of the cocoon. Several weeks into my first semester, I went to the Lisner Auditorium to hear Judy Collins sing. I can still see her standing alone on the stage with her long blonde hair, floor-length cotton dress, and guitar. From that day on, I was a huge Judy Collins fan. In December 1978, Hillary and I were on a brief vacation to London after the first time I was elected governor. One day, as we window shopped down the King's Road in Chelsea, the loudspeaker of a store blared out Judy's version of Joni Mitchell's Chelsea Morning. We agreed on the spot that if we ever had a daughter, we'd call her Chelsea. At the end of sophomore year in 1966, I went home without a job, but with a clear idea of what I wanted to do. It was the end of an era in Arkansas. After 6 terms, Orville Faubus wasn't running for re-election as governor. Finally, our state would have a chance to move beyond the scars of Little Rock and the stains of cronyism that also tainted his later years. I wanted to work in the governor's race, both to learn about politics and to do what little I could to put Arkansas on a more progressive course. The best candidate with a good shot at winning was a state Supreme Court justice and a former attorney general, Frank Holt. He had the support of most of the courthouse crowd and the big financial interest, but he was more progressive on race than Faubus and completely honest and decent. Frank Holt was admired by just about everybody who knew him, except those who thought he was too easygoing to make any real change. He'd wanted to be governor all his life and also wanted to redeem his family's legacy. His brother Jack, who was more of an old-fashioned Southern populist, had lost a hot Senate race to our conservative senior senator, John McClellan, a few years before.